If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Today we've got the latest episode in our Bayeux Tapestry series, presented by David Musgrove.
Welcome back to History Extra's Unravelling the Bayeux Tapestry series. This is episode 4, What's Missing from the Tapestry? I'm David Musgrove, Content Director for BBC History Magazine and History Extra. When news broke in 2018 that the Bayeux Tapestry was going to be loaned to the UK from its permanent home in Bayeux, I set to work about writing a book all about it, along with Professor Michael Lewis, who is the head of the Portable Antiquities Scheme at the British Museum, a tapestry expert and member of its scientific committee. That book is published by Thames and Hudson in April 2021 and is called The Story of the Bayeux Tapestry: Unravelling the Norman Conquest. In this 5-part podcast series, I've invited tapestry and 11th century history experts to join Professor Lewis and I to discuss the ins and outs of the tapestry and the way that we should understand it today. This episode, we're considering what's missing from the tapestry, which, as you'll find out, is quite a lot. And it's the omissions that actually tell us a good deal about the motives of the tapestry designers, the likely intended audience, and about life in the 11th century generally too. I'm joined for this episode by Professor Tom Lysons, who is Professor of Medieval History at the University of East Anglia and author of a recent excellent biography of King Edward the Confessor called Edward the Confessor, Last of the Royal Blood. Plus, we're joined by Dr. Emily Ward of University College London, an expert on childhood and child kingship in the early Middle Ages and co-editor with Professor Laura Ash of a recent volume of essays called Conquests in 11th Century England, 1016-1066. Now, most scholars of the tapestry would agree that there isn't likely to be much missing from the start of the tapestry, with its opening scene of King Edward the Confessor in conversation with Harold Godwinson. However, at the other end of the tapestry, there is certainly a good case to be made for the depredations of time and handling having meant that we have lost its original ending. I asked our panel what they thought might originally have been the tapestry's closing scenes. First to speak and give his view is Professor Tom Lysons.
One recreation or suggested recreation I've seen is of the tapestry ending with the coronation of William the Conqueror at Christmas in London. And that would turn it into a story about the turnaround of kings, starting with Edward the Confessor, going, of course, through the rise of Harold and then the fall of Harold, and eventually William being crowned at the end. So the whole thing potentially becomes a story of the turnaround of kingship, according to that reconstruction.
What do you think, Michael? Do you share that view? That's a fairly well-established sort of view, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I would sort of go for something similar. I guess what is interesting is what might be between the end of the kind of Battle of Hastings and then kind of leads up to that. Because obviously, as people who've kind of recreated the Bayeux Tapestry, you know, they kind of imagine all sorts of things that could have happened after the Battle of Hastings that aren't shown in the Bayeux Tapestry. But as we'll talk about today, there's obviously lots of parts of the tapestry that aren't in there anyway. I mean, another suggestion, of course, which is some people say, which I don't necessarily go for myself, is that it was never finished, that what we have now is pretty much the kind of end of the tapestry. And one of my students said to me the other day, which is quite interesting, is, you know, they're doing this Game of Thrones sort of tapestry at the moment. And they were religiously kind of updating it and updating it and updating it. I think they sort of still are. But because everybody was a bit disappointed with how the series ends, there's this bit like, well, do we care what happens at the end of the Game of Thrones tapestry? So maybe it's the same thing with the Bayeux tapestry. Who knows?
Emily, do you have any sparkling observations on how the tapestry might have ended or might not have ended?
No, I think I'm largely persuaded by the fact that it probably did end with the coronation scene. And I think the most interesting thing for what might happen from my perspective in between is whether we get any mention of what's happening in London at this point. So this is a key scene that appears in some of the other sources from around the time. And obviously is a very important one for what's happening with Edgar Etheling and his support. But we just don't know whether that would have appeared on the original tapestry. And we don't know how that would have represented that scene. And it's very unlikely, I think, that Edgar would have appeared himself. But it would have been quite a key point of sort of triumphal entry into London to kind of precede the coronation. So that would have been, for me, an interesting scene if it still was there. But obviously, at the minute, it's all kind of hypothetical imaginings of what might have come there.
Let's come back to that in a bit, because I think let's just go back to the start of the tapestry again. One of the other things that we don't get at all in the tapestry is dates. It doesn't tell us anything about when things are supposed to happen. We're supposed to just follow the narrative. So we assume that it starts in 1064 with this conversation between King Edward and Harold. Do you think it's at all surprising that that dates aren't given in a document like that? Is it something that we ought to that's worthy of comment or note?
I mean, I think it depends what you see the purpose of the tapestry as being. I don't think it's surprising that dates are there. It's very clearly presenting a visual account. The dates themselves might not have been quite as important. It's obviously a snapshot in time as well. So we're just seeing, like you said, these sort of key months. Really from 1064/5 and all the way through. So it's really at most 2 years, possibly as few as sort of 15 or so months that are being displayed on this tapestry. So I don't think that it's surprising that the dates aren't included. It's not trying to present itself as an analytic form of history, which is where we would obviously expect the years to come, you know, what happened in 1066 and what happened in 1067. But even in the annalistic form of writing, you often get entire years that don't appear in some of the Anglo-Saxon chronicles, for example. So no, I wouldn't say it's surprising it doesn't appear on the visual form. And I would say that the visual form is perhaps the reason that it doesn't.
What do you think, Tom?
Yes, I'd certainly agree with all that. I mean, all the images, sort of picture stories we have from that period, whether they're church wall paintings or embroideries like this one, don't have dates on them. Many of them won't have any guiding words to explain the action on them. So dates wouldn't have been important. I think what's important is the story that's being told. And on one level, that's a very specific story that occurred at a certain point in time, perhaps in the fairly recent past. But it's also a timeless story with timeless morals and timeless messages, some of which are elucidated in the margins by the use of characters from Aesop's fables. So we can almost pitch this story outside time if we want to and appreciate it on that level too.
I think there's an interesting point to put sort of in relation to what Tom's just saying about the point where it most clearly plays with time, which is the shifting of that deathbed scene and the funeral of Edward, where it puts the funeral procession first and then the deathbed scene afterwards. So there is clearly some playing with time that's happening there. I think that buys into sort of this argument that actually it's almost outside of time and it's able to do that because of the visuality of the source.
Yes, absolutely. And the lack of dates does allow for that time leap to happen. Michael, any observations on dates or lack?
Well, I go with Tom in terms of his inference that it'd be more surprising in a funny sort of way to see dates on it than not, actually. But one thing that some people have talked about, of course, is the kind of agricultural scenes that are in some of the parts of the tapestry in the lower borders, which may suggest to some people that it kind of infers that this is at a particular time of year. I mean, I don't think that is really the case, actually. But nevertheless, I mean, it is kind of interesting that you do have those moments and why they're there. And as already been said, you know, this kind of back and forth in time is quite an interesting thing. I'm not sure we'll talk about the Alfkiva scene or not, but that, again, people have talked about that being a kind of flashback, perhaps, or something that actually happened in time. So again, it sort of depends on your interpretation of the tapestry, whether you're seeing things in a real time or not, anyway, in certain parts.
Yeah, and the Alfgiva scene, we've sort of mentioned that in passing in this series so far. This is the kind of the very enigmatic bit where there's a woman having some sort of altercation with a clerical figure. Some people have argued that there's the architecture suggests there's some sort of portals that put it in a different place and time entirely. Let's talk a little bit about the stuff that really isn't in the tapestry there, because I think that is absolutely fascinating. And Emily, you've already sort of pointed us up in that direction. So I'm not going to go over the whole narrative of the tapestry again. I did that in the last episode, so our listeners know. yes, Michael, I did it at great length. Our listeners know what it's saying, but what it doesn't say is very interesting, is it? So it's telling one story. It's telling the story of the clash, basically the run up to the clash between two men, William and Harold, with Edward the Confessor as kind of this figure in the background. There are other bits to that story, but it misses out some really interesting elements. So let me stop talking. And Tom, what do you think are the most interesting bits the tapestry excludes from a political sense?
Well, we have to see the tapestry as a south of the Channel perspective, strong Brittany sort of angle in there. It leaves out northern events, so it leaves out the invasion of Harald Hardrada, accompanied by Tosti, only, of course, a month or so before, well, less than a month before the Battle of Hastings. And that's a crucial element of the 1066 story. So the tapestry is telling the story of Harold and William. It's focusing on that conflict between those two, and it's leaving out other key players, really important players, without whom we can't understand what's going on.
Let me just drop in a quick interjection here to remind you that what Tom is talking about here is the separate invasion attempt on King Harold II's kingdom in 1066. Came from the north with the Norwegian king, Harald Hardrada, leading an army alongside Harald's own estranged brother, Tostig, who had been exiled from England after rebellion in his earldom of Northumbria. Tostig had felt betrayed by his brother Harald in not supporting him against the rebellion and spent the early part of 1066 trying to recover his place in England, culminating in his joint invasion with Hardrada. Tostig and Hardrada defeated the forces of the Earls Edwin and Morcar at the Battle of Fulford Gate on 20 September 1066, but they were themselves defeated and killed by King Harold at Stamford Bridge on 25 September. It was then left to Harold to make the long journey back to the south coast to face Duke William of Normandy in his invasion, which of course led to the Battle of Hastings, which, as we know, does feature very prominently in the Biotapestry. Anyway, back to Tom to offer a bit more detail about why the Hardrada-Tostig story doesn't make it into the tapestry.
I think there are multiple possibilities. One is that whenever you tell a story, you select what to put in and what to leave out. And the emphasis is obviously on Harold and William, so that has to be in focus. And other characters can distract from that, so there may be a simple explanation for their omission. Another possibility is that whoever designed this tapestry didn't want to draw attention to the fact that William wasn't the only claimant to the throne, that there were other contenders in the running too. Harald Hardrada potentially, Tosti potentially, Edgar Etheling certainly. So there may be political motives, there may be more banal motives, which is to do with storytelling.
Hmm. And when you think about the audience, I mean, we've talked in previous episodes that the audience to this might well have been quite a militaristic knightly audience of men who'd like to see battle. So it's interesting, Emily, that we don't get these depictions of the battles of Fulford Gate and Stamford Bridge, which happened, you know, as Tom said, a few weeks prior to the big set piece Battle of Hastings. You would have thought that perhaps the audience might have quite enjoyed seeing a bit more of that that military stuff. So what's your take on why they're not included?
Well, I think one of the reasons is the tapestry is not an account of Harold's reign. And these are things that happen in Harold's reign. It misses out sort of the preparations of Harold's army, and it doesn't sort of think about things like the gathering of troops down on the southern coast. We get very little context of actually what's happening in the months of Harold's reign. He is named as king on the tapestry, but we don't see him ruling, really. We see him being crowned, or at least in this kind of handing over of the crown, his coronation. And then we see him in battle at his death. It's not an account of his reign. So I think focusing on events like Stamford Bridge in particular would have drawn attention to his military successes. I mean, obviously, we get the sort of prequel to his reign. We see him very clearly involved in the Poitou incident and in the Breton campaign. And that is the one point where he comes to the fore, sort of in that bit before 1066. But we don't see him as a ruling king. And I think the other thing that I think is missing that's perhaps more interesting as to why is the fact that it focuses so much on the Norman preparations, but actually doesn't really include very much information about that. So we don't see, for example, the ships moving up the coast from Dives to St. Valery. We don't see the procession of the saints' relics at St. Valery, which was an important event that some of the other sources after the conquest drew attention to. And that's perhaps more interesting because we get that lengthy description of shipbuilding and lengthy sort of focus on what's happening with the Norman and the French troops at that point. But we don't get certain of these aspects that are focused on in some of the other sources.
And why do you imagine that is the case? Do you have a view on why it's not there?
Well, possibly the fact that actually that trip up the coast ended up in a bit of a shipwreck. So that's not exactly a key event you want to draw attention to. That may not have looked favourably in terms of sort of divine blessing on the conquest in itself. And also, I don't know, but the person who designed the tapestry clearly loved ships. So they wanted to focus on the building process and perhaps were less keen to kind of place these in a specific location moving up the coast. I don't know.
That's a good point about their love of ships. We do see a lot of ships in the tapestry. That is undeniably true. A lot of ships and a lot of horses. Michael, Emily made an interesting point just there that if the designer had shown the Battle of Stamford Bridge, then that would have kind of added to that legend that's kind of building up of Harold being a worthy military figure, someone who's good in war. But I suppose on the flip side of that, if they had shown that battle, then that would be after Harold had, in the Norman story, perjured himself and taken the crown unfairly. So I suppose then it wouldn't have fitted that narrative of building Harold up. By that point, we need to see him being knocked down. Is that right?
Well, like you said, there's a lot of sort of spinning that could be done on interpreting this kind of story, can't there? I mean, there's various sort of aspects to it. You know, it depends on how you come to it. And as we've talked before in a kind of previous one of these podcasts, I mean, the tapestry seems to sort of tie this, walk this tightrope, this balancing act between giving enough information but not actually telling you what to think sometimes. I think it's quite interesting with what Emily was saying about the kind of the invasion fleet and the preparations, because actually, I mean, people, the Norman sources, you know, William of Poitiers, go into quite a lot of detail about that. So it's quite interesting that Norman accounts do talk about the kind of loss of life, the disaster that the crossing was initially, until it kind of got re-kind of scheduled, if you like. So that's kind of interesting. I think the Norman sources talk about that, and then the tapestry doesn't. So I kind of think sometimes that might suggest that, or to me it suggests that the tapestry's message is kind of slightly different to that. And it gives, again, it kind of comes back to this thing you talked about with this sort of binary clash and making it a straightforward conversation, if you like, between the claims of William against those of Harold. Certainly the case that Stamford Bridge in particular makes Harold look particularly impressive. I mean, no one can doubt that was a pretty impressive military victory for him, especially after the disaster, I suppose, of Fulford Gate, where he relied on his locals to do the job and they just didn't manage it. But sort of going back to something that Tom kind of mentioned, which I think is really interesting as well, is about Edward the Confessor as a sort of king in this, because kind of made me think, really, sometimes, I mean, and I guess Tom will, he might shout down on me for this saying this, but I sometimes see Edward the Confessor as very much a sort of southern king in many ways. You know, he's kind of got a lot better control, it seems to me, on the southern part of the kingdom. And the further you go north, he becomes a lot more dependent on other sorts of individuals. And of course, you know, Tostig's rule in Northumbria was a bit of a disaster, and hence which opened this sort of gate for this Norwegian invasion. So it is quite a complex picture, but I think from the tapestry's perspective, they know, obviously, Harald has become king. They don't, you know, question that in any sort of way in the tapestry narrative. It's fairly clear to be seen. And yeah, his next problem was dealing with William. And so it is presented essentially as a conflict between those two people, ignoring most other people.
Is that right, Tom? Is it basically a tapestry of southern England, which is why we don't see Hardrada and all the interesting stuff that happens in the north?
Well, that was the argument I was making, that we're seeing here probably a Breton perspective, a south of the Channel perspective, and maybe not much knowledge of what happened up north. Edward doesn't go up north in his reign, as far as we know. I say up north, I mean as far south as York. He doesn't even go up to somewhere like York. Harald does. One of the first things that Harald does in his reign, of course, is go up to York. But that's because he faces unrest, it seems, in Northumbria, whereas Edward doesn't. Not for many years, until, of course, the Great Rebellion of 1065, and that's largely because Tosti, who's very close to Edward, is trying to impose southern systems of government and probably taxation on the Northumbrians by that point. So although Edward stays in the south, he has the north in what seemed to be safe hands for a long period until the very end of the reign. Harald starts his reign with a lot of trouble in the north and feels the need to go up there himself in person, which I think is interesting in itself. But as Emily says, this isn't really a tapestry about Harald's reign. It's not Harald's story in that sense. Harald is a player in I think what's more William's story.
I think there's also another absent context, obviously, is the Scandinavian context is entirely absent. And that's, you know, again, what that would fit in with what Tom says. They're just not really that concerned with what's going on up there at the point that the tapestry is being made. They perhaps weren't aware, but it's also perhaps a dangerous link to make, to kind of look back to Harald Hardrada, which links you back to this kind of past of Knut and Harthe Knut, and you're getting there into kind of murky waters of recalling an earlier conquest and the fact that the throne of England perhaps is claimable through conquest in another way, and you don't necessarily want to draw connections between William and earlier conquerors.
We should stop and linger a second here. Emily has just invited us to consider the longer history of what's happened through the 11th century. She cited Harald Hardrada, who, as I've already mentioned, led a failed invasion attempt with Tosti from the north in 1066. The Scandinavian perspective goes back further than this, though. There had been Viking raiding and settlement in Britain for several centuries prior to this point. And in 1016, another Scandinavian invader, the Danish King Knut, had seized the throne of England from King Aethelred the Unready. Aethelred, who was father to Edward the Confessor, died in 1016, and his son Edmund Ironside briefly ruled jointly with Knut. When Edmund also died at the end of 1016, Knut ruled solely over England until 1035, whereupon he was followed by his sons Harald Harefoot and Harthe Knut. It was only on Harthe Knut's death in 1042 that Edward the Confessor was able to take the throne. It's notable to mention here that the short-lived king, Edmund Ironside, had a son, Edward, who went into exile after his father's death. And this Edward the Exile also had a son, called Edgar, who Emily has mentioned earlier, and who we come back to a bit later on, so keep an eye out for him. Now, before Michael takes up the story, I should explain that he's about to mention a figure called Elfgiver, who we talked about at the end of episode 3 of this series. We've not properly introduced her, though, so let me do that. There is a scene in the tapestry in the first half of the action, immediately after Earl Harald and Duke William have what looks like a heated meeting in William's palace in Normandy. The Elfgiver scene has been much discussed by tapestry scholars because it's so hard to understand what it's all about. It's captioned with the words "Where a Clerk" and "Elfgiver." And the lack of a verb kind of suggests it should have an ellipsis after it to tell us more. It definitely feels like there's a dot, 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 something happened. The scene shows a woman seemingly hovering slightly above the ground between two curious pillars topped with beastly heads. A churchman, clearly shown with a tonsured head, is thrusting his arm behind one of those pillars with the palm of his hand touching or hitting the woman's face. Beneath this scene, in the lower margin, is a man, mirroring the posture of the cleric, yet with a notable absence of clothing, and his genitals prominently on show. This naked man follows another naked man in the lower margin, who appears to be doing some sort of woodwork in the nude. This has all led to a lot of theorising and speculation as to who Elfgiver was and what this is all about. Michael is going to mention a couple of candidates, Emma of Normandy, who was Queen of England at the start of the 11th century and who was wife to both King Ethelred the Unready and the aforementioned King Canute, and also mother to King Edward the Confessor. Confusingly, Emma was also known as Elfgifu. Michael also mentions Elfgifu of Northampton, who was the first wife of King Canute. All a bit confusing, but you will cope. Anyway, back to the conversation.
Going back to this sort of Lady Elfgiver, I mean, it sort of depends what you think of her, isn't it, in a way? Because some people sort of do think that she is the Scandinavian story. You know, she's hovering there, kind of reminding people that there is a sort of background here, you know, that she could either be Emma of Normandy or she could be Elfgiver of Northampton. These kind of various people who are involved, obviously, with this really complicated, and I think that's one thing we all sometimes forget. Well, we don't forget, but we know's there, but it can be forgotten, is about how complicated these sort of dynastic links are between all of these different families across, you know, northern and kind of northwest Europe, particularly at this sort of time. It's so interrelated, and as sort of has been inferred, I mean, it's quite possible for anyone to sort of make a claim to the kingdom. It's just whether you're going to be able to take it. I think it's been said by a lot of people, really, that 1066 kind of completely overshadows 1016 and what happened before. I mean, if 1066 hadn't happened, we'd all be talking about 1016 or 1014, whatever you like, as being the most important event in the 11th century. But, you know, it kind of gets washed away, really, by the Norman conquest.
It seems like we're going to have to do Elfgiver. So, Tom, you want to say something, but is Elfgiver, as Michael said, is that our hook into the political context of the 11th century?
I don't have a clue who Elfgiver is. I really don't. She's one of these intriguing figures on the tapestry who obviously meant something to the audience, and that's intriguing in itself. We've got all sorts of little characters in there. We've got Turold, we've got Wadard, we've got Vital. We've been able to identify some of those. I'm not convinced that we have an identification for Elfgiver. And that makes it absolutely fascinating that she's there. I think she's one of three women pictured on the tapestry.
Yeah, and she's the only one named as well, just going to jump in there and say that. So yeah, the fact that her name appears singularly of all of the women, and there aren't very many on there, but that's important.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, I think we can be clear that she is there as an object of sexual desire. But beyond that, what the story is, I don't know. So whether she takes us out of the time of the tapestry, again, I don't know. If she does, she's the only figure on there who does. And I suspect that she probably is contemporary with the events, and there's some little side story there that we're unaware of.
I think I'm convinced with Elfgiver by Catherine Kharkov's argument that actually the three women who appear in the main narrative appear at points of political disruption, and they're used to at least reflect on power dynamics. And that is not my argument, that is Catherine Kharkov's. And I think I'm definitely convinced by that. There is something more to the appearance of each of these women. And it's one of these, you know, the suggestion has been put that Elfgiver is there as an in-joke that we don't understand from our perspective many centuries later. And whatever she's doing there, she's clearly understood by a certain audience that would be viewing that, perhaps not everyone. But I think it is clearly a commentary on some form of power dynamics and political disruption.
And so that argument that Catherine Cockrell was making is that these women kind of stop you in your tracks a bit and make you think that, you know, this is a moment you need to reflect on and try and understand whatever's happening in the tapestry at that point.
Yeah, and one of the other women, obviously, that appears and isn't named, quite interestingly, is most likely Queen Edith at Edward's deathbed. And that's another point of political disruption. After the conquest, this is a key point, you know, did Harold swear an oath? Was there a deathbed bequest? Who was the oath to? To what extent was Edgar Etheling involved in that context? All of these can be questions that can be asked about that deathbed scene, and the way in which the tapestry portrays it is very ambiguous, but Edith is there and is clearly an important part of that. And of course, it could be perhaps a hint that their marriage did not bear a son, and that perhaps allowed people like Harold to take advantage of a situation.
We'll talk a little bit more about the role and place of women in the tapestry in a second, if we can. But Tom, I stopped you. You were going to make a point, and then I made you opine on Elfgiva. But did you have something you wanted to say about the sort of the political background in the tapestry?
Well, the point I was going to make related to the earlier conversation about 1016 being dissolved by 1066, and I wanted to add really that 1016 was dissolved by Edward the Confessor's accession in 1042. Cnut's dynasty had died out by that point, and so really the hope of Cnut establishing a line on the throne, a house of his own, a sort of Anglo-Danish dynasty, if you like, was over by the time Edward took the throne in 1042. So I think that's quite a long way in the background for me, but I'm aware other people have different opinions.
Edgar Etheling's been mentioned a few times here as kind of the missing person in the story. But let's talk about Edgar. So Edgar was the person who was best placed to succeed Edward the Confessor in terms of lineage. That's a true statement, isn't it?
Well, I argue, of course, that he's Edgar's adopted son, and Barlow had made that same point in his 2002 biography of the Goblins, that, I quote, Edward probably adopted Edgar as his son, and he's paraded around as such and sort of held up as the prospective heir. And so he's a hot potato. You don't want to touch this. If you're one of the people creating these sources, you're creating the source, whether it's a tapestry or one of the chronicles in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle or the biography of Edward, you're creating it for the regime, whether that's Harold's regime or William's regime. You don't want to touch Edgar Etheling. You don't want to mention him. You want to erase his existence because he undermines the legitimacy of your candidates, you know, whether that be Harold or William. So Edgar is written out almost across the sources that we have, and we only get little glimpses of him almost by accident sometimes here and there.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly feel, as we say in our book, Dave, that Edgar is sort of written out of the story to make the tapestry a very simple one, like we said before, a conversation between William and Harold, and William taking this kingdom by force. And as we've talked about before, the Norman sources, you know, make play, don't they, of the fact that they see that Harold didn't have any legitimacy to rule. Well, you know, if Edgar Etheling's kind of hovering about there, then that sort of doesn't really help William at all as well. So, you know, I'm kind of with Tom on this. Pretty much is that, this is all about, the tapestry is all about not talking about Edgar in a funny sort of way. It's a story that's kind of avoids him. And as has been said, I mean, it is kind of interesting that he is sort of suppressed so much from the sources that I think it's, I mean, there's a long, I mean, if Edgar's always been in the back of people's minds, I think it's probably fair to say, who have studied this sort of period of time. But I think it's only relatively recently that he's been taken, well, when I say relatively recently, maybe in the last 20 years, but he's been taken relatively recently as I mean, most scholars of the period now sort of recognise that he had a legitimacy. The question is, why didn't that sort of happen in a way? You know, why was it the case that the Witan kind of overlooked Edgar at that moment in time? And I guess, you know, what we've said, and it'd be interesting to see what the others think about this as well, is that, you know, maybe there wasn't something that was quite right for his, it wasn't quite his time in terms of his experience, his age, which I don't think is necessarily a limitation at all. Maybe there was other aspects, or maybe Harold was just so powerful that he was able to make this sort of happen. I mean, that's, I think, for me, is the big question, is how did Edgar not become king, actually. Although we have to recognise, of course, it isn't about primogeniture at this sort of time. It's about who had the best sort of standing in terms of the kind of leading men of the country.
We've dropped Edgar in here, and for listeners who aren't familiar with him, we ought to just say who he was. Emily, you're an expert on child kings and kingship. You've studied this. Would you be able to summarise Edgar's story as to how he where he fits into the situation?
Yeah, so Edgar Atheling is the grandson of Edmund Ironside, who did rule England. So he's a grandson of a reigning king of England for a few months. And he has spent most of his life in exile because his father was exiled from the kingdom, probably in at the Kievan court, in Kievan Rus, possibly in Hungary for a bit of his childhood as well. He then arrives back probably in around 1057, either with his father, who's recalled from exile by Edward, or possibly shortly afterwards. And it's very clear that he's accompanying Queen Edith and King Edward as they itinerate around the country. He's addressed as Atheling, throneworthy. It's very clear that he is being prepared to be heir. And there are some interesting representations of what was happening around the point of the final year or so of Edward's reign in terms of oaths that might have been sworn to Edward to perhaps put Edgar on the throne after Edward's death. And that comes from sort of a source over from the monastery of St. Riquier in northern France and a monk, Hariulf, who's writing in around the 1080s, although it may have been based on an earlier source that's written very shortly after the conquest, possibly around sort of late 1060s. So there's some interesting evidence that suggests that Harold did basically took advantage of a situation in which he could claim power. He did so with the consultation of the leading men of the Witan, and he got them on side to be crowned. But yeah, it's very clear that the legitimate claim at that point was Edgar Atheling's.
And Edgar would have been a boy at this time, though. When he came back to England, how old were you being? What are we saying?
Yeah, he's possibly as young as 10 or 11, at most 14, 15. We have a very dubious reference that he's around the same age as William the Conqueror's son, Robert Curthose. But again, we don't actually have a definite birth date for Robert Curthose. And the term that the Latin sources use suggests within the same peer group, but that doesn't necessarily pin him to being exactly the same age. So it's possibly sort of around between 10, 11 and 14 or 15. And that's not an unusual age to succeed to a throne at that point. There are rulers of France and the German realm at that very moment in time who've succeeded as much, much younger in the German case, a five-year-old boy, Henry IV, succeeded to the German throne in 1056. So it would not have been unusual. And we can remember that William himself succeeded to his dukedom as a boy of about 7 or 8 as well.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
So, thanks, Emily. So, Tom, in terms of
the threat that Edgar posed to the contenders, William and Harold, after the death of Edward the Confessor. How realistic a threat was he? I mean, it must have been realistic for him to have been excluded from the Bayeux Tapestry, if we're taking that view that he's taken out because it was politically not expedient for him to be there. And I think you might have some interesting lines on his relationship to Harold Hardrada as well, and how that might have fitted into the story.
Yes, well, up to this point, every claimant of the English throne has been of the royal blood, either of the bloodline of Cerdic going all the way back to the 6th century through the House of Wessex, or the Danish bloodline, the royal bloodline of Svein Forkbeard and Canute. Harold's usurpation of the throne in 1066 is absolutely unprecedented in that Harold is not of royal blood. And so that instantly puts a question mark over his legitimacy. We know that as soon as Harold took the throne, multiple foreign powers, both to the north and south, decided that they weren't going to recognise him. And they either ganged up to form armies which would go and invade his kingdom or assisted others who were doing so. So Harold has a major legitimacy problem from the start. If you think of other usurpers in history, such as Richard III, Henry Tudor, they both face attempts by claimants to come and take the throne, and they're made to feel very insecure by people like Perkin Warbeck. I mean, as Tom Penn wrote in his biography of Henry VII, Henry VII gets absolutely paranoid about these pretenders to the throne. Harold has a real cause for concern because there is a legitimate contender for the throne. Edgar Etheling is the only one who has the legal title allowing him to succeed to the throne, which is the title Emily mentioned, Etheling, and he's very well connected. The best genealogical research today suggests that Harold Hardrada is his uncle, in that Harold Hardrada married his aunt Elizabetha. His other aunt, Anna, is married to Anne of Kiev, was married to the former King of France, and is the mother of the young King of France. So he has royal kindred to the north and south of England, who presumably would rather have him on the throne than Harold. And that may go some way to explaining the invasions we see manifesting from Norway and the large troops which are gathering in France to invade England too. I think partly because of the Bayeux Tapestry, we've fallen into the habit of thinking about 1066 as though it's a struggle between Harold and William, whereas in fact both of them were illegitimate usurpers who had no blood claim to the throne at all.
I was just going back to this point of who's missing from the tapestry. It's also interesting that Archbishop Ealdred is entirely missing. We get Stigand named Archbishop of Canterbury, but we don't get the Archbishop of York at that point. And there's a possible indication there that he's one of the ones who is perhaps most strongly behind Edgar Etheling in London after the Battle of Hastings. We also obviously don't get the Earls Edwin and Morcar appearing on the tapestry either. So they're other people who are possibly in London with Edgar. So none of these people who were perhaps on the leading support team behind Edgar Etheling actually end up on the tapestry as it survives.
But they're also, of course, northerners. They're all northerners, aren't they?
And it's exactly,
it's more northerners being left out.
So it's exclusion of northerners, which,
We're back round again then to what happened in London after the victory of William the Conqueror. And it takes us back to that point you made at the start, Emily, that we missed this possible support for Edgar in London after William had defeated Harold. But it's very interesting that we don't see that London element after the Battle of Hastings, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose, like Emily said, it's fairly obvious why we don't show it, because it's not really in the spirit of the story that the tapestry designer sort of wants to tell, really. I'm not surprised that this kind of, London sort of declaring for him is not depicted. I still kind of rattle about this idea about what actually did happen immediately after the death of Edward the Confessor. And I know we talked about it a little bit last time in terms of the death of Edward the Confessor and this kind of the touching of hands that's shown that kind of reflects what's found in the Vita Edwardi Regis, where it sort of suggests that Edward, it sort of puts the kingdom into Harold's care. And I mean, we can read these words in lots of different ways. And obviously it's not helped by the fact that it's translated from Latin into English, and then we use the words that we're sort of familiar with. But I've always kind of liked the idea, whether there's any proof in this, that Harold was sort of chosen as the person to kind of take care of the kingdom whilst this young boy, became a bit more of age.
What do you think, Tom? Is Michael right there?
No, he's absolutely right. And I used the parallel of Richard III earlier. And of course, Richard III is made Lord Protector in the first instance for the young princes before they disappear. And we might think of Harold as an 11th century equivalent to that, in that Edward is potentially nominating Harold as a guardian to look after Edgar until Edgar comes of age, when Harold should cede the kingdom to Edgar without impediment, according to Harold of Sanricier, the sort of contemporary writer who brings in a sort of neutral perspective on this from Ponthieu. What Harold then tells us is that Harold broke his oath to Edward to look after Edgar, and drove Edgar out of the kingdom and took the crown for himself. And he might well have done that for good reasons, because it was a very precarious position to be the protector of a young prince who might soon come of age, and he might have his own opinions about things, and he might not want a protector looking over his shoulder and overshadowing him all the time.
Time for one more quick pause. Edgar Atheling is, in my mind at least, the missing man in the tapestry. And hopefully the conversation above has shown why that was the case. And perhaps pointed up the fact that the reason that Edgar isn't as well known today as he might be, given how significant a player he appears to have been in the succession crisis that followed the death of Edward the Confessor, is precisely because he's written out of the Bayeux tapestry, which, as we've talked about throughout this series, has come to be such a dominant force in public understanding of the conquest, and perhaps even medieval history more broadly, because of its very survival as an artefact and the singular appeal of its simple and direct imagery. Edgar is not the only person who doesn't make an appearance in the tapestry who might have done, though. So let's go back to the discussion to talk about women and their general absence in the embroidery. So we've just had a conversation there for about half an hour talking about the political situation in 1066 and in the 11th century. And it's been almost entirely men that we've talked about. Emily mentioned a couple of women earlier on, but it's interesting that it is so male dominated there. Whereas your work, Emily, some of your research does inform us that actually women were political players and were important in the story at the time. So what are we missing, and why do you think we're missing that?
Yeah, well, I think the tapestry as it currently stands is a very, it's not only a very male-dominated visual art form, it's also a very militarily active, so youngish men, militarily capable young men, they dominate the tapestry overall. So it's a very homosocial environment. You see court scenes, you see dining scenes, but you don't see women sort of as part of the audiences for those. You see three women who we've talked about, Edith, Elfgiva, and the third one is a woman fleeing from a burning house, holding the hand of her young child.
And she's unnamed. We don't know.
And
we
she's unnamed. We don't know who she was, but to me at least, she represents sort of the unnamed women and children who would have been affected by conquest and warfare. And I think it's very tempting to see this as a very political and militarily focused tapestry. And that's one side of warfare and conquest. The other side is obviously what's happening to the women who are left behind when men are off at battle. Borgia of Bourgogne is actually a really interesting source to bring in here, because he tells us of this scene on the Norman coast as the northern French forces are leaving for England. He describes mothers and wives weeping for the men as they go off to battle. But that's something you don't see on the tapestry. So there are a lot of unnamed women who could have been brought into the story, but obviously that wasn't part of the purpose or perhaps the intended audience. But there is a very important, I think, aspect there that we haven't mentioned, which is that the anonymity of the women who are probably making this tapestry, that's a really important point, I think, to bring in there. This tapestry is the whole product of women's work as well. So moving us away perhaps from a political narrative to think about the sort of social history underpinning that the tapestry, that's women, almost certainly religious women, possibly nuns in the Kent Canterbury region has been one suggestion, who were actually responsible for the embroidery that underpins all of this. So it's thanks to them we have this. So I should say it's thanks to women we even have this as a source.
Other women are shown in the tapestry, in the borders, in the margins, but they're shown often in quite sexualized ways. So how does that how do you imagine that would have fitted in with the with potentially nuns being involved in the embroidery?
Yeah, the sexualized scenes are an interesting one. There's a lovely story about, to take us into a later context, there's a group of women who were sort of recreating the tapestry. I think it was in the 19th century. And the images they gave them actually redacted elements of the nude scenes so that they didn't have to, these women weren't sort of exposed to these male genitalia and naked women. But anyway, that's by the by. There are, I think it's three nude women depicted in the Borders, and they possibly were making a commentary on some of the scenes that were going on. So the fact that there's a nude man underneath the Elf Gviva scene has usually been indicated that is something of a sexual nature. So we can perhaps suggest that some of the other appearances of nude women would have been there. But I don't think we should necessarily assume that the nuns were unfamiliar with the female body, or the fact that this was perhaps a too raunchy for nuns to embroider. These are scenes that you might have seen also on sort of other artwork and other aspects of architecture within ecclesiastical settings as well as within secular. So I don't think that would have been something that was perhaps considered too dangerous for them to,
I'm not really sure I'd use the word nuns for the embroiderers. We don't know really who they are. They're women, probably, but, you know, from what sort of background, it's sort of difficult to say. It could be anything, of course. But one thing I suppose is quite interesting, and I think in some ways, you know, in relation to the lack of women in the tapestry, is that if we take the line that the tapestry is almost certainly borrowed from illuminated manuscripts, or parts of it are, and we kind of look at some of the likely drawings, like the Old English Hexateuch, Junius 11, et cetera, et cetera. They are absolutely full of women. And the stories that they're borrowing from are full of women, obviously by biblical stories. So I find that is even more interesting, actually, is that, you know, you've got these role models that they could have borrowed from in terms of the narratives that are full of women doing quite important things, you know, within the biblical context. I know it's mostly Old Testament, and, you know, some of those stories, I think I've just been going back through some of them, and they're quite shocking, actually, in many ways, to a modern audience, a lot of these stories of the goings-on in the Old Testament. But nonetheless, the tapestry designer is almost certainly borrowing from manuscripts that have loads and loads of women doing important things in these stories, and then they don't appear in the Bayeux tapestry. So it makes them even more kind of absent, I think, is the point I was trying to make.
And to give one example of that, some of the models of the horses, for example, tumbling, are copying images from Psychomachia, which is a 4th century text by Prudentius, which is kept at Canterbury. In this work, you have women personified as the virtues, battling other women who are personified as the vices. So you see lots of images of women fighting women. And those images of women fighting women have been borrowed to create fight scenes for men, and the women have been erased from them.
Yeah, just jumping off Michael's point there as well, I mean, there would be surely an absolute crucial moment to have brought a woman in would have been Queen Matilda of Flanders, or Matilda of Flanders as she was before her coronation. And you see that point where it actually refers in the inscription to William crossing in this large ship. Well, that ship we know was the Moro, which was financed by Matilda of Flanders. So that would have been an absolutely crucial point to bring in, surely, a woman who is very, very obvious from her lack in the tapestry, I think.
Matilda being William's queen. So it does all sort of point to it being a pretty deliberate omission to not include women in the tapestry.
Well, I think it's important to put it in a wider context of 11th century sources. The 11th century is quite unusual because we have two important sources commissioned by queens. We have the so-called Encomium of Queen Emma, which is a work commissioned by Canute's Queen Emma to celebrate her dynasty, circa 1041. And we have the Life of King Edward, commissioned by Queen Edith, circa 1065. And both of these works, although they are commissioned by women, by queens, and have a very important female input, they're not about women. They're about celebrating the glory of women through the menfolk. It's as though the glory of women was vicarious. It was reflected through the men. And that's very much the tenor, I think, in which we have to take these accounts. The Bayeux Tapestry is doing something slightly different. But even when we have sources with women behind them, the women aren't putting themselves centre. They're wanting to put their men centre, their dynastic achievements of their fathers and their husbands and their children centre. And I think that tells us something very important about how that society operates.
And I think that's, sorry to interject, but I think that is a really interesting thing for us, isn't it? Because obviously it's sometimes, and we do this all the time, you know, we have our kind of modern sort of value judgments and we want to see them somehow in the past. We think they should do this and we think they should do that. And, you know, as we talked about in the last episode, you know, a king had the attributes of a king sort of in the 11th century are very different to a political leader nowadays, although sometimes like people like to show the analogies between the two. But it is a completely different world in many ways to the one that we sort of live in now. And though we've kind of tried to like some of these characters, most of them are probably quite ruthless people because they live in quite ruthless periods, actually. Even the women, I'd say, as well. I mean, you know, people like Queen Emma, gosh, I mean, she's a nightmare, isn't she? But, I mean, yeah, they're pretty tough people.
I think there's also another woman sort of missing from the tapestry who does appear quite prominently in the 1066 story elsewhere, and that would be Geatha, Harold's mum, who ends up in Exeter after the conquest and is clearly part of the city holding out against William at that point. So that's another important kind of political moment where you see women being important within a political context, but the tapestry obviously doesn't go as far as 1068, so it doesn't get to that point.
It's interesting, though, if you look at the Vita Edwardi, the biography of Edward, that Geatha is also omitted there. She's mentioned on two occasions when the Godwins flee into exile. First of all, in 1051, when Godwin flees into exile, taking Geatha, his wife, with him. Then in 1065, when Tosti, her son, flees into exile, taking Geatha, again, his wife, with him. But she's afforded no place in the story, which I think is very interesting because it's probably the case that Edith, who is the central woman in that story, doesn't want any attention detracting from her. Possibly partly for the reason that Geatha was enormously fertile. She had lots and lots of children, and Edith didn't, of course. And this is one of the clouds that's hanging over Edith, Edward's queen, Harold's sister. She has no children. So Geatha is almost, you know, erased from the biography there as well.
But she could have also appeared at the battle scene or immediately afterwards where she's trying to negotiate for potentially for with William to recover Harold's body. It's William of Poitiers, I think, who says that William turned her down. She tries to buy her son's body back so she can give him a fitting burial.
Yeah, supposedly she offers his weight in gold, according to one of those accounts.
We've covered sort of higher politics and the context quite a lot now. I'd just like to spend 5 minutes as we wrap up just to talk about what the tapestry tells us or doesn't about everyday life in the 11th century, the social history. So if you were writing a novel today about the story of the Norman conquest, you might include some colour about what was going on in the background and, you know, describe some churches and things like that. We see some small elements of that sort of thing. We see some buildings and some architecture, and Michael talked about the agricultural scenes that are shown in the borders a bit. We see a lot of shipbuilding, as Emily talked about, but that's kind of within the military context, isn't it? It doesn't give us that much more colour about the 11th century, does it? Or am I missing something obvious? Tom, is the Bayeux Tapestry an excellent source for social history, do you think?
I could say something about religion, perhaps, which is one aspect of social history. God, who's obviously all important and sort of sitting at the top of the cosmos in the 11th century, appears once in the Bayeux Tapestry as the hand blessing Westminster when Edward's funeral cortege is going in there, signifying that Edward is seen as a holy individual and that his burial place is being blessed. But apart from that appearance, that sole appearance of the hand of God, that whole cosmos where you have God and the devil, saints and angels, demons, all those aspects of belief are missing. And it's easy to forget that these people subscribe to this belief system where there are all these gods and other beings who are making these things happen. You know, I mean, a number of the people who comment on the on the Battle of Hastings and the fall of the English, fall of Harold, I should say, attribute that to God. So God has a role to play, but God is largely missing. You've got a couple of fighting bishops in there, but that's about all.
Yeah, absolutely. Emily, what do you think? Is it useful for social history for understanding the 11th century?
Oh, I'm going to be a little bit controversial, I think, and say I think it's as useful for social history as it is for political history, and I leave that quite an open one. I think we've exploited it or historians in general have exploited it quite a lot for political history, and it's perhaps only more recently that people have turned to it for some of the social insights it can provide. It's obviously in itself, in many ways, a dubious source for doing that exactly, but I think it can be quite telling. So one of my favourite scenes, perhaps inevitably from what I work on, is the procession leading the funeral cortege into Westminster, and there are two bell ringers underneath this scene. Now, what one suggestion is that they're very small because of perspective. I perhaps propose another alternative and would lean towards the fact that they are small, in fact, because they are small people, they are children. And there is a lot of work that's been done on children's participation in liturgy and liturgical processions, perhaps not as bell ringers, but as choir boys, as people who are doing readings or chants. So for me, this is a key point to perhaps think, well, who are we forgetting when we think about a political context? Who are we forgetting within the sort of role of historical actors? And we're often not thinking about children, but here they are on a tapestry. And I think on another, you could flip that, and you could also, that can be a point to start then thinking about the audience of the tapestry and perhaps children being a part of that. If it was being displayed in either a secular or ecclesiastical setting, almost certainly part of the audience would have been made up of children, and they're often left out of who we think of as audience. So it's a point perhaps to spark the imagination from thinking about other people who are not necessarily a part of the political context, but are definitely a part of the social history of 11th century England.
I'm just trying to think if there's any other children. There's the woman at the end is leading a child away from the burning house, isn't she? Yeah.
And again, that kind of starts you thinking about the impact of conquest on children. There's a possible, I mean, there's a small figure upper mast, potentially, you know, could this be a small boy who they've shoved up there? But he's part of a group of men traveling across the channel. So maybe, yeah.
Tom.
I was so interested in what Emily was saying about child audiences, because I hadn't given much thought to that. But it did occur to me that one of our key sources for these events of 1065, 1066 is the Admo in Canterbury. And the Admo is an English monk born around about the year 1060 who writes an account of these events in the early 1100. He would have been growing up in Canterbury in the 1060s, 1070s, when the tapestry was there. And the account the story that he tells does map rather closely onto the scenes in the tapestry. I mean, just to an extent where I thought when I was writing about this that he might have been influenced by the tapestry. And it may well be that he was one of these children who saw it in situ in Canterbury in the late 1060s or 1070s or whenever it sort of started to emerge, or was being told the stories that fed into it in that context. And we have to remember that, of course, these stories are also circulating orally, and children are being told these stories, and children would have understood who some of these characters were and what was going on in ways that we today can't.
Maybe he's one of Emily's bell ringers.
Or maybe Edgar is, yes. I mean, who knows?
Michael, social history in the tapestry. I mean, a lot of the more bucolic scenes are based on manuscript illustrations from other sources, so not necessarily really telling us about what's happening on the ground in 1066 or the 1070s, but of an earlier period.
Yeah, so notwithstanding that fact, in some ways there are kind of quite a lot of snippets of information, though. So, I mean, obviously, if you take away what's clearly come from manuscripts and you're kind of left with the rest, if you like, there are kind of a lot of interesting images in the tapestry, which obviously people have, you know, talked about, or, you know, Tom and Emily have already talked about in some places. I mean, the obvious one, of course, is clothing. I mean, there's quite a lot of secular clothing depicted in the tapestry. Again, probably borrowed or similar to that you find in some of these late Anglo-Saxon manuscripts. But there are snippets of information that kind of lend us to believe that maybe the embroiderers were kind of paying a bit more attention to what people were wearing. Maybe not. Maybe that's reading a little bit more into it. There's obviously the cooking and feasting scenes, again, borrowed from manuscripts, but elements of them, you know, seem to reflect, you know, how people may have ate and drink. And obviously people have played on the differences between the Norman feast scene and the English feast scene, where the English basically drink lots but don't eat much, and the Normans, it's a bit the other way around. So I think there are kind of insights into social history. I think one of the things that about the tapestry that we all know is because it's so colourful and because of the date of it, when you open these history books, you kind of see images from the tapestry that relate to events in the 11th century, the 12th century, the 13th century, the 14th century. I mean, you go on and on and on almost. It's incredible that people kind of use it to illustrate the past, even now, when really it is pretty much borrowed from contemporary manuscripts, which again, you know, sometimes are relating, as you suggested, Dave, what was happening in the, say, the late 10th century, early 11th century, but they might actually fossilise things that were going on well before that as well.
Okay, we've covered an awful lot of ground there, talked about all sorts of interesting things. We ought to wrap it up. So I'm just wondering, I'm just going to throw it around everybody to offer any concluding remarks or say anything that haven't given you an opportunity to say about what's missing from the tapestry. Tom, anything you'd like to throw in by way of conclusion?
Yes, I think ultimately what's missing from the tapestry, a proper explanation of what's going on, I think, is what's missing. And when we use it as a source, we have to be very careful to read it on its own terms and not to try to import meaning into it from the other sources that we have.
Michael?
Well, I think based on what Emily's been saying, I think it'd be quite nice if the tapestry had Edith was here, 1066, over the top of the sort of deathbed scene, perhaps, just to kind of make it sure that it is her that we're talking about, that's kind of weeping at the bottom of Edward's bed.
And thanks, and Emily?
I mean, I'm just going to end with one of my favourite scenes, which is, I think, perhaps links back into what you were saying with the social history, is these men wading into the sea carrying their dogs is one of my favourite scenes. And you just, I think from that, you sort of think about the realistic portrayal of people actually having to climb on board boats and things. Even if some of these are copied from manuscripts, it's a visual insight that sparks at least a little bit of imagining back to what some of the realities of these events might have been like.
It is one of my favourite scenes, and I've got a dog, and to try and carry a dog whilst you're getting onto a ship would be something of a feat, wouldn't it? But no, it is a lovely scene, and it is one of the most visually appealing things, I think, of the tapestry. Professor Tom Licence, Dr. Emily Ward, Professor Michael Lewis, thank you very much. We've now done what's missing in the Bayeux tapestry. So next time you look at it, think about what's not there as much as what is there. Thank you very much. So that's the end of part four of our History Extra Unravelling the Bayeux Tapestry series. Thanks to Professor Tom Licence, Dr. Emily Ward, and Professor Michael Lewis. The fifth and final episode explores the legacy of the tapestry and its place in public history today. And for that, Professor Lewis will be joined by Professor Michael Wood and Dr. Janina Ramirez. Just a quick note that the book that Michael Lewis and I have written, The Story of the Bayeux Tapestry, Unravelling the Norman Conquest, is published by Thames and Hudson in April 2021. And we've written a feature on what's missing from the Bayeux Tapestry, which obviously follows on from this discussion you've just listened to, in the March issue of BBC History magazine. Plus, of course, you'll find all manner of great tapestry content on our website, historyextra.com, including a piece about why women are at the heart of the Norman Conquest story.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman.